From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The basic charge is that on February 6, 1996, quote, a Chinese arms merchant, with all that ominous sound to it, attended a White House coffee. And that individual, Wang Jun, is a suspicious character, and his presence at any meeting involving Americans needs to be looked into. If that's the case, then we're going to have to look at George Bush, Brent Scowcroft, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Alexander Haig, all of whom have met with Wang Jun in recent years.
A look at day two of the campaign finance hearings and toxic fertilizer. We look at the growing use of industrial waste spread on America's farms. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senators investigating campaign finance abuses have announced that they had learned that Attorney General Janet Reno would object if their committee offered immunity from prosecution to John Huang, whose money-raising practices are at the heart of the inquiry. For that and other reasons, many of the senators expressed serious reservations about granting Huang immunity, raising new doubts about whether he will ever appear to testify. President Clinton is weighing a tougher tobacco policy pushed by the nation's health experts while rejecting the proposed tobacco deal's restrictions on regulation of the nicotine. Clinton said he was concerned that the deal, which would settle 40 state lawsuits against cigarette makers, would forbid the Food and Drug Administration from reducing or banning nicotine if doing so would create a black market for full-strength brands. A hardline Bosnian Serb police chief implicated in ethnic cleansing was killed in a clash with NATO-led peacekeeping troops trying to arrest him on war crimes charges. This, according to the independent B92 radio station in Belgrade. This apparently is part of a NATO attempt, which has not been made public, to bring Bosnian war crime suspects to justice. 34 years later, the FBI says it has new information on a church bombing in Alabama that killed four young black girls. Investigators say they're reopening the case after secretly reviewing evidence over the past year. The top FBI agent in Birmingham says the 1963 bombing remains a sore part of American history that officials would like to heal. A Ku Klux Klansman was convicted in the case in 1977, but authorities have said at least three others were involved. The FBI says the timing of the investigation is not sparked by last month's release of a Spike Lee documentary on the bombing. Parents in a Southern California school district are suing, saying conditions at the schools amount to child abuse. The parents in Compton are going after the state's education department, demanding the schools be cleaned up, repaired, and made safer. It says there are broken toilets, dried-up water fountains, along with exposed electrical wires and playgrounds strewn with glass. And it describes schoolyards where gangs meet and kids pack guns. In Spain, the Central Military Court convicted a senior military intelligence officer yesterday of leaking secret files on a 1980s dirty war against Basque separatist rebels. And in this country, Yale University has rejected an offer from a playwright to fund a gay and lesbian studies professorship. Larry Kramer, a 1957 Yale graduate and AIDS activist, says he presented Yale with about a dozen proposals. All were rejected. He blames what he calls extreme homophobia. Yale says gay and lesbian studies is too narrow a field for a permanent professorship. Kramer didn't say how much he offered the school, but it costs about $2 million to endow a professor's position at Yale. A New York pathologist says the last man executed in Florida was still alive when the electricity was shut off. Jonathan Arden was the first witness called in a hearing in Jacksonville, Florida, on the constitutionality of the state's electric chair, known as Old Sparky. He says reports show Pedro Medina still had a weak pulse after flames shot from behind the face mask he was wearing when he was put to death back in March. Arden also testified it's virtually impossible to tell whether Medina suffered before he died. Condemned killer Leo Jones is seeking to block his execution, saying the electric chair amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The Jacksonville judge is expected to issue his ruling in August. Top House Republicans and Democrats privately discussed a pay raise for members of Congress yesterday, but reached no decision. This, according to a participant in the meeting who spoke on condition of anonymity. Most members of Congress earn $133,600 annually, while leaders receive more. The last pay raise occurred in 1993 when lawmakers received an $8,500 boost, or 3.2%. The House has approved funding for the CIA and other spy groups, but it's admonishing the agencies to do a better job of analyzing their information. Lawmakers also want the agencies to do more on-the-ground intelligence gathering by agents. Congress never makes public the budget for the CIA and 11 other intelligence agencies, but it's estimated to be about $30 billion. Congressmember John Conyers is pushing for intelligence budgets to be made public. Choosing home state jobs over Pentagon savings, Congress has killed any chance of another round of base closings before the end of the century. In a 66-33 vote in the Senate late yesterday delivered the death blow to President Clinton's proposal for two more base closing rounds in 1999 and 2000. Both the House and Senate versions of the 98 defense budget now have no provision for more base closings. That's some of the news at this hour. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Senate committee investigating the campaign finance scandals during last year's election campaign heard from its first witness yesterday. Amid sharp exchanges, former Democratic Party finance director Richard Sullivan flatly denied that coffees at the White House and stays in the Lincoln bedroom were fundraising events. We're bringing you extended excerpts of yesterday's campaign fundraising, as we are doing every morning during these fundraising hearings. We begin with Richard Sullivan and his opening statement. He's the former Democratic Party finance director, and he also will continue his testimony today.
The Democratic National Committee raised an enormous amount of money for an important election with enormous significance for the country's politics. In the 1995-96 period, we almost tripled the amount raised in 1991-1992 election cycle. And the vast, vast majority of the money we raised complied in letter and in spirit with every legal, regulatory, and indeed ethical requirement of fundraising. I was never, and I emphasize never.
Richard Sullivan, the former Democratic Party finance director. He was questioned by Republican and Democratic senators in the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. We'll hear from Republican Senator Pete Domenici, a New Mexico senator on the committee, who questioned Richard Sullivan.
That kind.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Now, on August 8, under this heading of DNC fundraising dates, there's a coffee on August the 8th, and a coffee on September the 7th, and a coffee on November the 1st, and there's one on October the 6th, and then there's the vice president with a coffee at September 14th and 15th. Now, you have looked at this memo, right?
Yes.
Now, I want to ask you, what is this memo all about? It says fundraising dates received to date from the White House, right? Is that right? It says that? Fundraising dates?
Yes.
Now, do you see where it says DNC fundraising dates a little further down?
Yes.
And then it says the President of the United States. That means the President is going to be at the coffee, right?
Yes.
And then there are several dates described as coffees, and you see those. And these coffees are the same ones we always hear about at the White House. Is that right?
I believe so.
And this document describes them taking place on fundraising dates. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So they were really fundraisers, weren't they?
Senator, the coffees helped us with our fundraising. I was the fundraising director, but they were not fundraisers. They were not fundraisers.
They were not fundraisers. As you see it, and at least as you testify here,
that's correct.
In spite of the fact that the DNC called them fundraising dates, in spite of the fact that the memo from various of the hierarchy from you says fundraising dates, they weren't fundraisers.
That's correct. The coffees were a tool in helping us motivate and energize the people that we needed to motivate and energize to help us raise $130 million that we wanted to raise in 1995 and the amounts that we wanted to raise in 1996 and 1995.
Now, Mr. Sullivan, You have indicated in your deposition that you made a distinction based upon tickets, ticket prices, events held at a hotel. And then you said, we didn't really expect these coffees to raise money. Is that correct? You said that, didn't you?
Senator, I expected the coffees to help us raise money. That's why we had them.
Well, look, I'm kind of confused, so let me move on to another exhibit for you. Now, right at the top, it says projected revenue and raised to date. So let's just pick the one dated January 17th. The president is holding a coffee, and look what it says. Under projected revenue, it says $400,000, right?
Yes.
And then raised to date, $400,000, right?
Yes.
Now, if that coffee wasn't a fundraiser, it sure did yield a lot of money. In fact, it yielded precisely the revenue projected by the Finance Committee of the DNC. Isn't that correct?
Senator, the coffees were very helpful to our overall fundraising goals. They allowed us to get in people from around the country who had been supporters or we were hoping would be supporters to help us with events in the future, to get them, allow them the opportunity to hear the president, be it at the White House or at the Starbucks coffee shop across the street, and to come out motivated.
I normally love to hear you ramble on. It's great, but let me just stop you for a minute. Who prepared this exhibit that had the projected amount of money and that you hit it right on the head in terms of the money raised from that breakfast, that coffee that I'm talking about?
I believe Erica Payne probably prepared it.
And who is Erica Payne?
She was Deputy Finance Director.
So the Deputy Finance Director had decided in advance that the January 17th President of the United States coffee should raise $400,000 worth of revenue, and it did, correct?
No, it did not.
Did not?
No.
Raised to date, $400,000.
That's what the document says, but it did not raise anything. It helped us in our long-term goals of raising the amount that we wanted to raise in 1996. Helped us get
my
some
friend, I don't have the documents here, but are you telling me that the people that attended that January 17th President of the United States coffee did not contribute $400,000 as your finance person said?
No.
It didn't produce it?
That's correct.
Well, why did they put the $400,000 here? Just for a memo?
It was part of an overall plan to get to the $130 million goal that we wanted to get to.
Now, for the first time since you've been here, I really believe you are spewing words calculated to confuse the issue. The truth of the matter is, certainly there was a big goal in mind. Every campaign has a big goal in mind. My little campaign has a big goal. And we do a lot of things to raise money. We don't have a White House, and we can't do it out of a Senate office because it's illegal. But that doesn't mean that within that framework, certain events don't raise a certain amount of money. And my question to you is, did these coffees yield campaign contributions or not?
They yielded campaign contributions over the course of 1996.
And that is Richard Sullivan, the Democratic Party finance director, being questioned by Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico. He was then questioned by Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois about the infamous Buddhist temple fundraiser that Vice President Gore attended in Hacienda Heights, California. The question of whether Richard Sullivan knew whether it was intended to raise money, whether Vice President Gore knew that it was intended to raise money. Also, the senators are considering whether to grant immunity to some of the people who participated in that fundraiser.
The event was originally supposed to be at a home or a restaurant, some in another location. John, that didn't work out for scheduling reasons. John then came to me and said, we'd like to hold this event at the Temple Community Center. And I said, well, John, you know, you can't have a formal fundraiser at a religious, anything of a religious institution. And he said, I agree. He said something along the lines of, I concur with that, and we will no longer have a formal fundraiser.
Did Mr. Wong advise you whether this center had ever been used for political events?
Yes, he
did.
By
any other individuals?
Yes, he did.
Did he note any names of individuals who had used this center?
As I recall, I think he mentioned Congressman Hamilton, Senator McConnell, maybe Congressman Berman, and Lieutenant Governor McCarthy, former Lieutenant Governor Leo McCarthy.
So let me make sure I understand. You told Mr. Wong, after you learned of the location that he had discussed, that this event could not be a fundraiser.
That's correct.
Did Mr. Wong give you his assurance that it would not be a fundraiser?
Yes.
And without that assurance, did you have the authority, or was it your role to comment to the Vice President's office about whether it should be scheduled? Was that one of your decisions or recommendations?
Yes.
So if, without Mr. Wong's assurance that it was not a fundraiser, would you have recommended that the Vice President attend it?
No.
Did you speak with anyone in the Vice President's office, a member of his staff, about your conversation with Mr. Wong about the nature of this event?
Yes, I did.
With whom did you speak?
David Strauss.
Was anyone else party to that conversation?
No.
So this conversation, were you party to this conversation between Mr. Wong and Mr. Strauss about this Buddhist event?
I believe, yes.
And can you tell us what you remember from that conversation?
John reiterated the conversation that he and I had had, he knew that it was not proper to hold a formal fundraising event at a religious affiliated institution, and that it would be still be helpful to us in the raising of funds over the course of the next couple of months, but that it would not be a formal fundraiser.
Richard Sullivan, the former Democratic Party finance director, being questioned by Democratic Senator Richard Durbin. He was also questioned by Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter about Wang Jun and his visit to the White House. Wang Jun, the son of a Chinese political leader, himself the head of a large corporate conglomerate in China, and an arms smuggler as well. Specter asked him questions.
What minimal effort? And I understand your testimony that extensive vetting was not done by the White House, but what minimal effort is done in a context where a third party, Ernest Green, makes a $50,000 contribution, known to be an employee of Lehman Brothers, and you have a man who is the son of the Vice President of China, a notorious arms dealer, in a context where AK-47s are shipped to the United States in the biggest arms seizure ever, and the President of the United States himself saying all of this is clearly inappropriate. Now, the time sequence is sort of complicated, but prior to the time that Wang Jun came to that coffee, it was well known in the newspaper clips about his being the son of Wang Zhang. And people have not gone to the White House coffees without funds. And there is this $50,000 for Mr. Green of Lehman Brothers to cover it. Now, what minimal steps were taken by the White House, DNC, to see who was meeting the President of the United States?
Wang Jun was a guest of Mr. Ernest Green in the United States of Lehman Brothers. And we'll have more on him when we come back. Senator John Glenn also deals with the Chinese arms merchant. When we come back after this break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our last excerpt of the campaign finance hearing of day two yesterday, led by the Governmental Affairs Committee in the Hart Office Building. Its chair is Fred Thompson. The Democratic minority chair of the committee, or the minority leader in this committee, is John Glenn, the Democrat of Ohio. He, too, questioned and talked about Wang Jun, the Chinese arms merchant. It was Richard Sullivan, the only man to testify yesterday. He will also be testifying today, the former Democratic Party finance director. But this is John Glenn's comments.
I just want to put this into proper perspective. The basic charge is that on February 6, 1996, quote, a Chinese arms merchant, with all that ominous sound to it, attended a White House coffee, and that individual, Wang Jun, is a suspicious character, and his presence at any meeting involving Americans needs to be looked into. If that's the case, then we're going to have to look at George Bush, Brent Scowcroft, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Alexander Haig, all of whom have met with Wang Jun in recent years. The meetings occurred because Wang Jun is the chairman of China International Trust and Investment Corporation, CITIC. That's a $20 billion conglomerate with businesses all over the place internationally. It serves as the chief investment arm, as a matter of fact, of the whole Chinese government. Would you agree that's a fair statement from what you know of this man?
Yes.
Yes. Now, he's a key figure for virtually any U.S. company interested in major economic involvement in China. Let me give some examples. In April 1996, George Bush went to Beijing with the president of the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies, the president, Dean O'Hare. Now, according to an AP report, and I quote, while there, Bush introduced O'Hare to China's president, Jiang Zemin, and brought him to meetings with the China International Trust and Investment Corporation, CITC, the government's investment arm. Now, I got to be fair about this. It doesn't say they met with Wang Jun personally, but they brought to that company. It was a normal procedure for people wanting to do any business in China. Chicago Tribune, March 23, 97, offers more details. And it, quote this, this is in quotes, in April 1996, 2 months after his White House visit, Wang was host at a Beijing dinner that included former President George Bush and National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, end of quote. The same Chicago Tribune article notes that CITIC, this is in quotes, CITIC is guided by the 13-member CITIC International Advisory Council, which includes American executives such as former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz and New York insurance magnate Maurice R. Greenberg, staunch Republicans who represent firms with substantial business interests in China, end of quote. Shultz attended the Council's March 1996 meeting in Beijing and indicated to the Chicago Tribune that he planned to attend the 1997 meeting as well. Now, let me hasten to add here. I had a lot of dealings with George Shultz when he was here in Washington, D.C., and he was one of the finest people to serve in government. He's one of the most honorable men I ever dealt with in government here. And certainly I'm not casting any allegations at George Shultz because he happened to have a meeting with a $20 billion corporation out there in China or wherever. Further, according to a March 16, 1997 Washington Post article on Wang Zheng, and I quote, he has received former President George Bush and former Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. Wang calls Kissinger a good friend. End of quote.
Senator John Glenn, the Democrat of Ohio and the ranking minority member on the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, which is holding campaign finance hearings throughout July and into September. Well, familiar names, aren't they? Ken Silverstein, our guest right now. Ken Silverstein, who did a piece in The Nation magazine February 17th of this year called The New China Hands, as Democrats and Republicans deal with the sticky issue of who comes to the White House, deal with this issue of who has access to politicians. We see it clearly is bipartisan, isn't it?
Oh, sure. There's no way that you can say that either the Democrats or the Republicans are responsible for China policy. I mean, you saw in the recent MFN vote that both parties endorsed the idea of continuing most favored nation trade status for China. There's just too much money involved for these members of Congress to say no. You saw the same sort of thing with NAFTA. You know, when you have every major corporation in America backing a given piece of legislation, it's real tough for the opposition to beat them. I mean, I'm sorry to sound so cynical, but I think that's a pretty accurate statement. It is extremely difficult. It's when quote, our side wins victories, it's more likely because there's a split at the higher levels. And in the case of China, there's a consensus, a broad consensus, that this is an important ally and that we're going to maintain normal relations with that country. And so you see both Democrats and Republicans eagerly advancing a policy of let's be friends with China.
It's interesting that President Clinton criticized President Bush when he was running for president for coddling dictators and promised a tougher line toward Beijing. Wang Jun, who is the subject of some of the campaign finance hearings yesterday, visited the White House for a coffee at the behest of Ernest Green of Lehman Brothers, isn't the only Chinese leader, I guess you could say, or related to political leader and corporate leader himself, who went to the White House. You, in your piece, talk about other such leaders like General Chi Hua Tien.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been this very cozy relationship between the upper levels of the two governments. I mean, don't forget, shortly after the crackdown in Tiananmen Square, when there was all this furor and the American public was outraged about what took place there, just months after that, Brent Scowcroft, who was then National Security Advisor under George Bush, dashed off to Beijing to sort of patch up relations. And in fact, on that very day he arrived, the Chinese government, I guess feeling emboldened because the U.S. had made clear by sending such a high-level figure that it wasn't going to take tough action, they beat up a group of student demonstrators. And then afterwards, of course, after Scowcroft left government, he's been a leading proponent of increased trade with China. He goes over there with corporate executives. He speaks to Congress. He addresses the Heritage Foundation. He attends public forums and always talking about the need for better ties with China. Of course, never mentioning that he has an economic stake there because he has business interests. He represents corporations that have big money at stake in China. So, sure, I mean, there's this very, very clear at the top, there's a clear, deep affection, mutual affection between the two governments.
You also mentioned the former National Security Advisor, now moved higher up, Sandy Berger, and his relationship to China.
Yeah, sure. I mean, here you go. Here you've got a Democrat in a very important position in the Clinton administration. Well, before he joined the administration, he worked at Hogan and Hartston, which is a firm that has been retained by a number of big corporations to lobby specifically on the issue of extending most favored nation trade status for China. And in fact, Berger himself lobbied on that very issue in favor of MFN when he was at Hogan and Hartston. So it's an across-the-board phenomenon. And you can I can't think of a single former Secretary of Defense or former Secretary of State in the last 20 years who does not have some business dealings with China. It's a bipartisan phenomenon.
I should clarify that Sennberger is the current national security advisor for China. You talk about large corporations like Allied Signal, AT&T, Caterpillar, Cargill, Motorola, and the big three automakers at the forefront of the China lobby.
Boeing is the leader of the China lobby. I mean, there are about 10 firms that really are most active, but there's no question that Boeing is the leader. One of their top corporate officials, a guy named Lawrence Clarkson, made a very revealing comment about his view towards the importance of China. He said, they sell one of every 10 planes to China, Boeing does. It's an enormous market. You're talking billions and billions of dollars. Clarkson said quite forthrightly, if U.S. and Chinese ties suffer, we're toast, was his direct quote. Boeing has expended millions of dollars on the China issue alone. I mean, that's everything from hiring lobby shops in town to funding bogus PR campaigns where, you had Hill & Knowlton, one of the big PR shops in town, creating...
Patton Boggs as well.
Patton Boggs worked on the issue. But Hill & Knowlton led a campaign called the China Normalization Initiative where they produce these sort of wonderfully cuddly tapes about how wonderful China is and how delightful life was there and how the economic opportunities were marvelous, never talking about political freedoms. And then they sent this out to the Kiwanis clubs and the Rotary clubs and to schools to be shown to high school kids. You know, and so there's an enormous effort from lobbying Congress to influencing public opinion, and Boeing is definitely the leader of the pack.
Well, Ken Silverstein, I do hear your daughter in the background, and
yeah.
I know you have to go. But
I'm alone here with a 2-year-old. It's hard to have an interview.
If you would like to give the phone number of Counterpunch, your investigative newsletter that I think everyone should have when you get tired of reading the pap that comes out of a lot of the corporate media, it's nice to hear read some investigative pieces, the kind that you do. What is the number?
It's 202-986-3665.
That's 202-986-3665. Thanks
right.
very much, Ken Silverstein. He is co-editor of Counterpunch with Alexander Coburn, and he did this piece, New China Hands, for the February 17th issue of The Nation magazine. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll take a little musical break, talk a little more about campaign finance, then go to the issue of toxic fertilizer. And as we've said over the last few days, we will continue to bring you the campaign finance hearings. We'll bring you extended excerpts and analysis and continue to deal with the issue of campaign finance, both as it's being dealt with inside the Beltway in the Hart Building by the Governmental Affairs Committee and also outside, looking at groups that are dealing with campaign finance around the country, dealing at the state level, trying to push through ballot initiative or through law or through state legislatures, campaign finance initiatives. And Democracy Now! Is engaged in a little kind campaign finance campaign ourselves. We are offering our listeners a mug to send to the White House that says, Dear President Clinton, Coffee, Tea, and Me. Every mug that is sent to the White House, and he's received more than 100 from our listeners, is included with the mug, a letter that says, Dear President Clinton, I heard that you've invited big donors, corporate executives, bankers, and arms merchants to have coffee and conversation with you at the White House. I may not have much money, but I do have serious concerns about our country's future. I still believe in government of, by, and for the people and care deeply about public policy and the state of democracy in America. I welcome the equal opportunity to share my thoughts with you in person. Coffee, tea, and me. And it's signed, well, by you. If you call us to send that mug off, of course, you can send your own mug with a letter like that. You can call us at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. One mug costs $19.97 in honor of the year to send to the White House. If you want to get one for yourself as well, you can send $30. But the number to call again, 1-800-735-0230. And you can have your mug with a message sent to the White House. Well, moving from inside the Beltway, although it is an issue that affects us all, to another issue that affects everyone, is the issue of toxic fertilizer. Several years ago, farmers in the central Washington town of Quincy began to wonder why their wheat yields were declining, their corn crops thin, and their cows sickly. After painstaking investigation, a group of farmers started to suspect their fertilizer and, more specifically, what was in it. And now, in a stunning new investigation, the Seattle Times newspaper reported this past week on what the farmers discovered, that industrial toxic waste is increasingly being recycled into fertilizer all across the country. Joining us now are two people who have been intimately affected by this fertilizer. Dennis DeYoung is with us. He is a lifelong farmer from Quincy, Washington. He lost his farm in the early 90s because of declining crop yields, which he attributes in part to toxic waste and fertilizer. Nancy Witte also joins us from Washington, an occupational therapist, special educator who has been in the field since the early 70s. Her brother Tom lost his Central Washington farm in the early 90s as well, in part because of the toxic waste in his fertilizer. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dennis DeYoung, why don't you briefly tell us your story?
Hello. I don't know exactly where to begin.
Well, since we only have a few minutes, why don't you tell us how you ended up with fertilizer that had toxic ingredients in it on your land?
Well, I had a farm, and I leased it to another person. And Cinex, the local fertilizer company, they had a waste pit in the town of Quincy. And somehow they made an arrangement, and they used it for the fertilizer on that farm. So when I got it back, it was basically dead.
They used
the company and started to investigate it, and this is where we led to today.
What was in the fertilizer?
They said that it was pesticides, so the state basically looked for pesticides, but got examining one of their tests, we found cobalt. Well, there isn't that much cobalt involved in fertilizer, and the cobalt level was higher than the zinc level. So that kind of started us on a path, and the more we investigated, we found beryllium and cadmium and chromium, and we started asking questions, where did this come from? And the state was very reluctant to work with us on that issue. They basically wanted it to stay under pesticides. So we started with the Freedom of Information.
Can you speak as loud as you can, Dennis?
Okay. We started with the Freedom of Information, which is a terrific act, and we uncovered more and more things that proved that there was waste coming into fertilizer. This was about 4 years ago, and as we moved along, well, finally Doug Wilson, Seattle Times, got involved with us, and
we're going to talk to Duff Wilson in a minute, who broke the story. But Nancy Witte, what are these things, cadmium, cobalt, beryllium, doing in fertilizer, and how do they affect human beings and animals?
Well, they're not supposed to be in fertilizer. They like nitrogen fertilizer, it's only supposed to be nitrogen and water. And my brother Tom had nitrogen fertilizer applied to his ground when he lost the 400 acres. He's still farming with his dairy farm and 200 acres. But when he tested the residue that was left in his fertilizer tank, that's when he found these heavy metals. And that's when he and Dennis started looking and were really aware of what was there. But the Seattle Post-Intelligencer had an article out on the 5th, and they said fertilizer additives used in the state include mine tailings from a lead smelter in British Columbia, cement kiln dust from a Seattle company, and ash from a Spokane electrical utility. So they're admitting that this stuff is really coming into the fertilizer.
How?
It's being mixed. We don't have all the details. Duff can probably answer that based on his research better than we can.
Well, we'll ask him in a second, but how did it affect your brother Tom's farm, and how did it affect, for example, the cows?
He used, he lost six cows. He had grown corn silage and corn grain and wheat, and he fed the corn silage to his dairy cows, and shortly after that, he lost six cows to cancer.
And what is the standard rate for cattle having cancer?
30% to 50% of what they should have been.
And what does he attribute this to?
He thinks it was the arsenic that caused the problem. And he has tested some of the corn silage. There's some corn silage left from that year, and we tested it, and it showed arsenic.
Well, after the break, we're going to go to the man who broke the story, Delph Wilson, who tells your stories, Nancy Whitty and Dennis DeYoung and others, and also talks about a pioneering mayor who's taken this issue on. We'll talk with a New York State legislator who is taking this issue to the legislature, and we'll talk with a state chemist who deals with the issue of regulating feed and fertilizer. Dennis DeYoung and Nancy Whitty have been our guests. They're both lifelong residents of Washington and have dealt personally with the issue of toxic fertilizer. You're listening to Pacifica Radio Democracy Now. I want to thank you both for being with us. And when we come back, we'll continue the discussion. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion of toxic waste and fertilizer. Duff Wilson is an investigative reporter at the Seattle Times, where he's worked for 8 years, and he just authored a major series on the issue called Fear in the Fields: How Hazardous Waste Becomes Fertilizer. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Duff.
Nice to be on.
Well, the stories of Nancy Whitty and Dennis DeYoung may surprise people. It certainly shocked us when we saw the articles that you've written. How did you discover this?
Well, Mayor Martin, the mayor of this small town in eastern Washington, came to me, laid it out a little bit, you know, saying that they suspect that hazardous waste are being recycled into fertilizer, and I couldn't believe her. I thought if even one half of what she was saying was true, I would be surprised. So I started investigating it.
And what did you find?
I found that 90% of what she says or more is true. Where big businesses that have hazardous or dangerous waste to get rid of, if they can save millions of dollars by recycling it, do. It's our national priority to recycle. And if they can recycle it into fertilizer, that's great, because then they save money disposing of it in a regulated landfill, and they might even be able to make money on it as a fertilizer.
So this stuff, which is supposed to be going into landfill because it is so hazardous, is going in to fertilizer.
That's right. And it's with the permission of the government, by the way. This is regulated on a state-by-state basis in this country. So it's not like in most of these cases what they're doing is illegal. It's, in fact, legal. What the problem is that nobody really checks back for these toxic tag-alongs in the fertilizer once it's initially approved. In most cases, the farmers aren't told. The public's not told. Our standards here are not as safe as other countries, Canada and Europe. There's just a lot of questions that need to be answered about this.
You know, the other day during our news headlines, I read the story and read some of the things found in the fertilizer that you wrote about in your story. In Gore, Oklahoma, a uranium processing plant is getting rid of low-level radioactive waste by licensing it as a liquid fertilizer and spraying it over 9,000 acres of grazing land. In Tifton County, Georgia, more than 1,000 acres of peanut crops were wiped out by a brew of hazardous waste and limestone sold to unsuspecting farmers. And in Camas Clark County, highly corrosive lead lace waste from a pulp mill is hauled to southwest Washington farms and spread over crops grown for livestock consumption. You said in Tifton County, Georgia, where this 1,000 acres of peanut crops were wiped out by the brew of hazardous waste and limestone sold to unsuspecting farmers, it was legal.
Oh, yes, it sure is. The Georgia authorities approved it. What they did was apparently they put it on a little too thick or something that killed the peanuts. There's a university researcher at Colorado State University who looked into that in some detail. The farmers there in Georgia don't want to talk about it because they're still trying to sell their peanuts, and they might like to sell their farm someday too. But Jessica Davis at Colorado State University looked into it and just says apparently the zinc in the fertilizer built up and killed the peanuts. That's the first case I found in this country of this product actually killing some crops that were meant for human consumption. And it's really kind of a good thing that the zinc killed the peanuts. They're especially sensitive to zinc. And that means that the cadmium that was in the same product, didn't go up into the plants and into the consumers of those plants. And cadmium's a lot more dangerous to people than zinc.
Duff Wilson, I should say that we invited the Fertilizer Institute onto the show. I spoke to Kathy O'Hara Mathers, who is Director of Public Affairs, and they agreed to come on, but then they called back about half an hour later and said she talked with people in the office, and they decided they wouldn't come on because the emotional stories of the farmers would be heard, and they just didn't want to have to deal with it.
Oh, darn.
Instead, they'd deal with the negative publicity. But
yeah.
They did say that George Latimer, who is our guest as well, mm-hmm. would be able to deal with the issue well enough.
He is
the Texas state chemist, responsible in part for regulating feed and fertilizers in Texas. He's a member of the American Association of Plant Food Control Officials and a professor at Texas A&M University. So I guess, George Latimer, you're also representing the Fertilizer Institute in their eyes.
No, I can't say that I am representing the Fertilizer Institute at all. I don't represent anybody except the state of Texas and the consumers. And the industry also, but my job is to see that the law that Texas has enacted is enforced. So I don't represent anybody except the people of Texas.
Well, let me ask you about these examples that I just read. The Gore, Oklahoma uranium processing plant getting rid of its low-level radioactive waste by putting it into liquid, using it as liquid fertilizer. All of the heavy metals that we've heard that are now going into fertilizer. How is it that this is legal?
Well, it may or may not be legal. In the first place, most state laws, including Texas's, have a section which says that it is a violation of the law to apply anything that is dangerous to plants. And indeed, the association that I represent has modified that to include animals, water, humans, and other areas of the environment, so that it is not necessarily legal to apply these materials, and I don't know the circumstances of these particular cases as to whether they were actually applied as fertilizers or not. You have to realize that there are many land applications that can be done that don't require any license at all. If in Texas, for example, a material is not does not make plant claims, namely that it increases the plant growth, they can spread it without the permission of anybody.
Right, as long as it's not a dangerous material.
Well, there are limits, of course, to the because the EPA and the Texas Natural Resource Commission has land application maximums, so that there are limits in that regard. And I think it's not quite reasonable to say that they are applied either legally or without knowing the circumstances under which these particular applications were granted. In the one case, as Duff just mentioned, they applied it higher than they were allowed to. Well, that's an illegal use. So that a number of these circumstances may not be quite the way they seem at first glance.
Now, Duff Wilson, you found that waste contains cadmium, a heavy metal that studies show can cause cancer, kidney disease, and neurological dysfunction, diminished fertility, immune system changes, birth defects at certain levels of consumption. You point out that in Canada, it's much more severely regulated, and that the philosophy there is, until you can prove it's safe, you can't use it. The philosophy here is, until you prove it's unsafe, you can use it. George Latimer, would you say that's exaggerating things, or that's pretty much the state of things?
Well, I think that there has to be a reasonable compromise. For example, zinc is never added at very low levels to fertilizers. it isn't, you're not applying zinc as the pure material. You add it in the part per million range. So even if cadmium were there, the cadmium is probably at a level which is not toxic.
Well, Jeff Wilson, is this what you have found?
Well, in some cases, certainly that's true. And what George was talking about is that the number of states, most states have laws against, obviously, adulterating fertilizer or applying anything as fertilizer that's dangerous to plants. So they try to apply kind of, subjective standards, to that to assure that the fertilizer is safe.
We do know what, for example, is a toxic level of zinc in plants. I think you have to understand something, and I think we have to talk here about legitimate fertilizer manufacture. We have to understand that one of the reasons that I exist is that there are rogue individuals and rogue firms which do violate the law, and no one, including the legitimate fertilizer industry, has any interest in seeing that they are other than put out of business.
Right.
So some of these circumstances may occur simply because of inadvertent behavior, or some are deliberate, but they are illegal.
George right. Latimer, what about sludge in fertilizer, human waste?
Well,
unprocessed.
Unprocessed human waste cannot be used. However, processed sewage from various cities is sold. Mill Organite is one of the prominent ones, which is sold nationwide in terms of using it in both as fertilizers as well as mulches. Most compost let me put it this way. The only time that most state fertilizer regulatory agencies can act is one if the material makes what's called a fertilizer claim. Otherwise, our law does not touch an individual. We have, for example, in Texas, New York is sending its sludge out to be spread in West Texas on land there, but it's spread as a sludge. They make no claims for plant improvement. Therefore, we do not control it. Now, if
Amy,
Steph Wilson,
I think it's important to distinguish between sludge and this other fertilizer, because the sludge or biosolids are regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. Other fertilizer, for the most part, is not. The sludge is checked for heavy metals. Other fertilizer, for the most part, is not. I think those are very important differences. Why there's a potential for undetected heavy metals in non-biosolid fertilizer.
Well,
I also want to mention before the hour's up that the complete Seattle Times series is on the web at seattletimes.com, and it's not at all exaggerated. I think that you'll see it's, if anything, understated. We've received an email from the Far West Fertilizer Association, thanking us for being balanced and fair and for not, trying to scare people, because we don't really know whether these practices are unsafe, but we do know that sometimes they're not watched, that the public and farmers have not been told.
Well, Duff Wilson, you point out that, if, for example, in one case, you have this guy who runs a silo who has what is considered toxic waste in it, but somehow, and it surprises even him, he can give it out to put into fertilizer.
It doesn't surprise him. He's been in that business for years and years. That's the it's a hazardous waste that's regulated under the federal law, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. KO-61 is the designation for precipitator dust. It received a specific exemption from Congress when the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act went into effect that defined hazardous materials. They said, because this business was already set up, that it was legal for them to recycle this particular hazardous waste into fertilizer. In that case, the selling point is the zinc, which is good for plants. The toxic tagalongs are the lead and the cadmium, which aren't any good for anybody. They remove some of the lead, but not all. By spending a little more money, probably or almost certainly, they could remove more of the lead. So it becomes a question of profitability of some of these industries that are recycling the fertilizer versus how much of the toxic tagalongs they remove.
We're talking to investigative journalist Duff Wilson, Texas state chemist George Latimer, and we're joined by New York State Senator David Patterson, who is calling for the use of toxic waste and fertilizer to be outlawed, is introducing a bill into the New York State Senate. Can you explain what this bill is, State Senator Patterson?
Well, to be specific, I'm not calling for the introduction of toxic waste to be outlawed. What I'm calling for is the labeling of products that have actually been grown on land where sewage sludge was recycled into farm fertilizer. I think what was being discussed before, the fact that perhaps the difference in Canada as opposed to the United States, since the burden of proof that something become unsafe before it's taken off the market is what I was really aiming at. Apparently, the National Food Processors Association, when they realized that products were being grown on land that was using this farm fertilizer, opted out of using these products. And then some of the corporations that were involved, Nestle and Heinz and others, decided not to use these products. And all I wanted to do was to extend the same protection to consumers. I do not know the answer as to whether or not the recycled sewage sludge is dangerous, but it just struck me as strange in the research that we found that scientists at the Cornell University College of Agriculture and Life Sciences reported that toxic materials in sewage sludge are absorbed into certain leafy vegetables. And I guess we would just trying to put some legislation together to, in a sense, publicize this issue and to get people to take a further look at it.
George,
may I ask a question about your bill, Senator? You're aiming at the product after it's grown rather than the fertilizer itself. Is that
exactly
correct? I'm sorry?
Yes.
Okay. So that wouldn't solve the problem that to some extent we're talking about, namely the farmer wouldn't necessarily know what he's putting on his land.
Well,
I make that point because we in Texas, for about a year with the industry, have been discussing the need to put on our fertilizers a list of ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And those negotiations are continuing.
Right.
So that we understand that there are certain there's certain information that consumers may well wish to have.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that when a farmer gets biosolids or sewage sludge, they know what they're getting. You know, they know this is biosolids. It may have some small amounts of heavy metals from the industrial waste in the sewage that it started with. When a farmer gets fertilizer, other kinds of fertilizers and custom mixes, they don't know and they don't expect that it's going to have recycled heavy metals.
Now, the Fertilizer Institute says that all fertilizer is labeled. Is that true, George Latimer?
That's true. They're all labeled, but they are not extensively labeled. Most state laws require two things. Number one, that they must guarantee the nitrogen, the available phosphorus, and the soluble potash.
We have 10 seconds.
And then any other elements that they wish to guarantee, they can guarantee.
But it's not absolutely all there on the label, everything that's in the fertilizer.
And no ingredients have to be listed at all in most states.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. David Patterson, New York State Senator.
Thank
George
you.
Latimer, Texas State Chemist. And Duff Wilson for the investigative series you've done. And folks, if you'd like to see it, you can get it on the web at seattletimes.com. Or you can call the Seattle Times in Seattle, Washington. That's www.seattletimes.com. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineers, Errol Maitland and Andy York. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Thanks also for production help from Fuff Vollmeyer. If you'd like to send us email, you can do it at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And we're on Real Audio on the web at pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!